Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeed.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, July 22nd, 2007, and this is show number 106. Well, you might notice the audio sounding a little bit different today. Many weeks, months ago, I recorded once with the windows open because it was really hot. And I got all these emails from people saying, "Do you have birds?" Because you could hear the birds outside. Well, I have dutifully kept the windows closed all this time. But you know what? It's too hot to do that. I end up just, glowing like a pig, if you will, because the window's closed. So I have it cracked open today, not too far, but you might hear a truck go by or some of those birds again. But bear with me. Let me know if it drives you crazy or if you don't care either way. Shoot me a note about that too. Well, this week I'm going to spend some time whining about my iPhone. Then we'll learn a way to store files online, either for your own easy access or for sharing with others. Friend of the show, Sam Caldwell, is going to show us an interesting comparison of Apple service versus Microsoft. I'm going to give an accessibility suggestion, and I'll tell you about yet another great tool to help you recover disk space on your Mac. I'll tell you why Google might not need to worry about competition for its online office suite, and I'll show you an odd little tool to enhance web searching in Safari. I'll close with one of the coolest little tools for working on screenshots that I've come across in a long time. Sounds like a great show. Well, like I said, let's kick in with an iPhone whine. I figure you don't mind if I'm talking about the iPhone as long as I'm saying bad things about it, right? Don't get me wrong. I'm having a love-hate relationship with the iPhone right now because it's definitely an awesome little device. I mean, I love being able to pick up my email on it, surf the web, like really surf the web, having all my contacts right there and synced up just perfectly. I didn't even check the weather in Italy where my daughter is roasting. It was 92 degrees at 10 at night the other night. So that's the good news. The bad news is on the battery and email fronts. Let's start out with the battery. Well, I think I'd mentioned this earlier, but I'd been noticing that my battery was starting to drain pretty quickly. I remember by 9:30 one morning, the little indicator was already partway down, like maybe 20% down. So I'd called into Apple in the first few days, and I logged a trouble ticket with them, just saying I'm kind of concerned, I think something's wrong. But since I couldn't really quantify the problem, we just left it at that. As you might recall, I also had the problem that the charger block for the wall charger wasn't working at all, so I got that replaced at the Apple Store last Saturday. When I talked to the guy, the genius, we both figured that maybe I wasn't getting a full charge, which was causing my battery drain problems, because I was charging off the laptop. And if I had the wall charger working, that would surely give me better results. So, over last weekend, I left the iPhone on the wall charger for about 12 hours, and I noticed I still didn't get the little plug icon showing that it was fully charged. As I mentioned last week, I found a description on wirelessinfo.com about how you can tell if you're not getting a full charge. If there's a gap on the right side showing that it never made it quite to the end, didn't fill up, that meant that you weren't getting a full charge. I put a photo of my battery indicator after 12 hours of charging in the show notes so you can see what they meant. Okay, back to the Apple Store on Monday night. I figured I'd just get in there right away, not wait until the weekend. So after dinner, I went over there at 8 o'clock. I'm a little tired at this point, but at least I'll get help quickly because it's a school night, right? Well, remember that the iPhone problems take first priority, right? Well, they fell all over themselves, telling the three of us waiting for iPhone issues that we were a very high priority and that the genius would be right with us. So much for the whole idea of it being a school night. The store was hopping on a Monday night. There had been like 35, 40 people in there the whole time I was in there. In fact, when they closed the store at 9 o'clock, they had to usher that many people out of there. They were buying stuff like crazy, mostly computers from what I could see. Oh, you'll notice I'm still in there at 9 o'clock, aren't I? Yep, the three of us are still waiting to even see the genius. Well, it turns out it's a really good thing that I didn't wait till the weekend to go in, because the first guy that got helped had a completely locked up iPhone, and the genius tells him that it's past 14 days, so he's supposed to send it back to Apple. Oh man, the poor guy's face just fell. And then the genius said, I'll give you a new one anyway. Whew. Big relief for him. But it's important to note that after 14 days, even if it's completely failed, they don't hand you a new iPhone in the Apple store. 14 days. That's really short. You know, that doesn't happen in regular retail stores that I can think of. Okay, so now it's about 9:30, and they have another guy helping number two in line, so they get to me at about 9:45. And get this. The guy, without even looking at the phone or asking me any questions beyond finding out that it's not charging, says, well, have you done a full system restore? I just about lost it right then. I leaned over the counter and I said, okay, let's get the whole story out here, shall we? I called AppleCare 5 days ago with this problem, and I grabbed my iPhone and I shoved it in his face and I showed him the note I'd written in the note section of the iPhone that had the case number, which I had so carefully logged. That was exactly why I called. And then I flipped open to my email where I had mailed myself the photograph of how the charger wasn't going fully charged. So I said, here's the picture of it not fully charged. And I was in here Saturday to get a new charging block because of this problem. And I've been staying here for 2 hours. Don't you think somewhere along the line, somebody could have suggested a full system restore earlier? Oh, I'm getting all excited here. Well, anyway, he kind of stuttered and said, I'll get back to you. So he wandered off to help guy number two. And then finally, he turns to me around 10 o'clock at night and says, okay, we'll give you a new phone. Man, I was about to stroke out before he said that. One thing I ain't in a situation like this is a wallflower, you can tell, can't you? He would have gone home with scars if he hadn't conceded the point on that one. So anyway, I got my new iPhone, charged it overnight, and now I have a happy full battery. And now it's not until like early afternoon that the indicator even begins to budge. I've been playing with it constantly. I passed it around to my son's friends yesterday. And they must have played with it for 2 hours straight, playing videos, doing all kinds of stuff, making phone calls. We had a good old time. And when I put it to bed at night, it was down only halfway. Okay, now what's my second wine? It's my .Mac email. Okay, get this. I can send and receive my Podfeet mail. I can send and receive my Gmail email. But I can't send .Mac email if I'm on the Edge network. Works fine if I'm on Wi-Fi, but it will not send on Edge from .Mac. Well, that doesn't make any sense. Why do my completely mutant systems work, but their own email doesn't work? Well, I made a call to AppleCare, and they escalated me to Heather. The initial account was created by when I just synced it up with my Mac, and it pulled it over automatically. So she suggested I delete the whole thing and set it up on the phone, just doing it from within the phone, choosing the .Mac pre-configured option. Okay, I did that. I sent an email on Edge and all was good. Oh, thank you so much, Heather. This is great. I hung up the phone. Then I tried to send a second email from .Mac and it failed. Oh, come on. So I waited a couple of days and on Friday, I spent an hour with my new little friend Nathan at Apple trying to fix this. We tried .Mac. We tried Pop. We tried IMAP. We tried to define the port in the outgoing mail server. We tried to use Gmail's outgoing mail servers. No matter what we did, the .Mac account would send one stinking email on Edge and then fail when you send the second one. Can anybody explain that? Well, this makes no sense at all. Nathan was really good. You know, he was changing just one thing at a time and we tested. He changed one thing and we tested. We did all these tests. I mean, literally over an hour we were on the phone doing these very controlled experiments, but we never figured out what we should have been doing instead. Could not figure it out. So finally, we settled on a less than optimum solution. AT&T has given them the AT&T outgoing mail server name so that people sending from their own ISPs that won't allow outgoing email away from their home service can still send mail. This was not intended for use by .Mac, since .Mac doesn't care where you are, in theory. But if I put in their outgoing mail server, which, by the way, is cwmx.com, I can send and receive email on Edge. Well, the reason this is less than optimal is because now I can't send on Wi-Fi. Great, thanks. Well, in my case, if I'm on Wi-Fi, it means I'm at home, and I have my laptop where I prefer to get the mail anyway, so it's not a huge impact. But this is such an interesting problem to noodle. I hope there's a resolution to it sometime that actually makes sense to me. If Vinny, you guys have any ideas about this? I'd sure be curious what could possibly cause it to be able to send mail once and not the second time. Well, I've probably gone way over my iPhone minute, but like I said, at least it's whining minutes, so it's not as annoying as gushing over it. The one thing I want you all to be thankful for, though, is that people like me are out here on the bleeding edge, kicking the tires, finding the flaws, and helping the developers come out with better products for the more sane amongst you who wait for revision 2. The advantage people like me get is we have the coolest thing for the longest amount of time, but it sure doesn't come without a price. Well, listener Sam sent us in an audio file of an experience he had this week that helps to maybe keep in focus that Apple is as fallible as the next company. But his explanation is all the more vivid because he's comparing Apple to Microsoft. Listen to his experience figuring out how to solve this problem with both Apple and Microsoft's quote-unquote help.
I'd like to share one Apple versus Microsoft support story. Last night, after downloading yet another Apple iTunes QuickTime update, this one apparently designed to fix problems caused by the previous updates, I noticed I could no longer launch any of my Microsoft 2004 Office applications. I trashed the Office files and tried to reinstall. To my dismay, the Microsoft installer would not respond, and I was left with only the second option of dropping all of the files on my hard drive. I reboot and retry. The Office icons do a little dance, but no launch. At 3 a.m., I take a Valium and go to bed. After a fitful sleep, I awake fearing the worst, that I will have to reinstall the operating system. I grab a cup of coffee and call AppleCare. I was put on hold a mere 15 minutes until connected to a very nice lady in India, who after 5 minutes was disconnected. Another call. This time, a 20-minute wait. Now I get a nice gentleman in India, who after telling me to uninstall and reinstall Office, as well as showing me how to check my hard drive for errors, announces, "It's not an Apple issue. Sorry, you'll have to call Microsoft." My heart sinks, and I notice a few more strands of gray hair falling to my keyboard. If you saw my head, you would understand why it's tragic to lose any more hair, gray or not. With trembling fingers, I dial Microsoft tech support number, and after the 3-minute hold, I'm connected to a very cheerful lady in Eastern Canada. She promptly informs me that the issue is with the early July QuickTimes iTunes update, and that according to Microsoft policy, she should send me back to Apple. Yet she spends the next 45 minutes taking me to the Apple website and to the desired 297.2 megabyte combo patch that I need to download and install in order to use Office. It was indeed an Apple issue, which should have been immediately recognized by the two Apple Care representatives I talked to. The Microsoft tech stayed online until we were convinced I could use all of my Office applications. I have to give Apple an F and Microsoft a well-earned A++. So much for the fuzzy, warm feelings I thought I would get using the iMac.
I played Sam's experience for you, lest we get cocky thinking Apple is without flaw. That might be a cut above in hardware design. They might have really good statistics on the quality of their products, but they're still staffed by humans, and humans can be helpful, idiotic, thoughtful, obnoxious, resourceful, and rude. I'm really glad the woman at Microsoft helped you, Sam, and thanks for reminding us that even Microsoft can be good to us. Well, I want to take a break here with an accessibility minute. I think the reason I instinctively take into account the needs of the blind and deaf community is because as an Apple user, I've always been in the minority. I wonder if I'd be so attuned to the cause if I'd grown up in majority Windows world. Well, anyway, the reason I bring this up is I'd like your help with something. You know how you go to a website, and in order to play, They make you identify some weird configuration of letters and numbers in order to prove that you're not a spammer. Well, those weird letter things are called CAPTCHAs, and they're pretty darn effective at keeping out the bad guys. But it turns out they also keep out blind people. Imagine how lame it would be if half the time you tried to enter a website, you ran up against a brick wall that kept you from getting in. Well, some sites include a button that says something to the effect of, "Click here if you cannot read this CAPTCHA," and it allows the blind or visually impaired user to get a call back from a human to help them enter the site. Wow, that sounds like a perfect solution, right? Well, not if you think about it. Imagine trying to enter, say, your own banking website, and you have to sit by the phone and wait for them to call you. That's not accessibility, that's a deterrent. And unfortunately, in reality, they frequently don't call back at all. So there must be a better way. It turns out there are alternatives that allow blind people to come in the front door, but still keep the bad guys out. It's an audio version of the CAPTCHA, or audio CAPTCHA. For some reason, many companies just don't employ this technique and can actually be violating federal laws on accessibility in some places. Many people, like Daryl Shandro of the Blind Access Journal at blindaccessjournal.com, are working to change minds, to increase knowledge so that companies always include accessible options that are as good as those for us without disability. I'd like to suggest that in our own way, we all help this cause in a really simple and easy way. Each time you encounter a visual-only CAPTCHA, find the Contact Us link. Just drop them a quick little line that says, "Hey, where's the audio CAPTCHA? Why would you want to limit your audience this way?" Imagine if each of us did that, maybe we could actually catch people's attention. I like the idea also of pointing towards their business. You know, people listen to what's in it for them. Well, they'd have more customers if they included the blind too. Heck, there's 10 million blind people in the U.S. alone. Would you want to cut out 10 million potential customers? That would be mad. Anyway, think about making this tiny little effort every time you run into a CAPTCHA. I don't know about you, but I'm annoyed by them anyway, so I wouldn't mind, you know, bugging the people that put them in there in the first place at the same time. You can use your own words, but just drop them a line, let them know that we think this is an unfair practice and stupid business. I think a lot has been said on this next problem. You need, want to send a big file or a huge pile of files, like photos, or for example, to somebody, a friend of yours. How do you do that? Well, your first instinct is to try and email it to them, but your email service probably won't let you send anything that big. Or even if it will, your recipient won't be able to receive it. A lot of mail systems stop you at 5 megabytes or even smaller. So what are you going to do? Well, I had exactly this problem last week. I had 20 megabytes of files that I desperately needed to send to Bart. Since I have a server for podfeet.com, I could have FTP'd the files to my server under normal circumstances. That's not something everyone can do, but it wasn't a problem for me. Until I realized that at work, they have a firewall that prevents FTP access to the outside world. Now what? Well, I remembered hearing about a service called Box.net for moving big files, so I decided to give this a whirl and see if it was as good as everyone says. Well, Box has 5 tabs, Home, Individual, Business, Enterprise, and Sign Up. I hit Sign Up, created a login, and it instantly let me log in. I didn't even have to wait for an email telling me to click here to authorize or read a CAPTCHA. I didn't check out the Business and Enterprise tabs, but if you're looking for a way to collaborate with clients or teammates, you might want to check out their offerings for that. Anyway, once you've logged in, you'll see 6 new tabs, and they start you on a page to explain how different parts of Box work. They explain that you can simply store files and share them with others, which is what I needed right away. They also show you how to share files on your blog. You upload to Box, and then they give you a Box widget to embed in your blog. No worries if you suddenly make the next Numa Numa song video that goes viral and have your bandwidth bill suddenly be bigger than a house payment. It's all going over to Box. Well, the first tab is for My Files, which is so intuitive. You can create folders to put your files in and choose to share one folder but not another. It's all point and click and has nice big fat buttons, so you can't possibly miss how to do this. No manual to read, see? When you click on upload, you get a couple of choices. You can either simply browse to the file you want, or you can choose the drag and drop method. That opens a separate window with a Java applet. I love drag and drop, so I opted for that method, and it worked like a charm. I was very impressed with the upload speeds. I'm on a fast connection, but I don't usually see anything near full speed. I tested it this week, and I saw 100 kilobytes per second upload, which is 800 kilobits per second, which is just about the full upload pipe that I have. I think the max I've ever seen is about 985, so that was very impressive. You can create folders on your My Files page and drag files and folders between them. The only thing that tricked me up was how to tell it to share stuff. Turns out if you hover over a file or folder, a little blue tick mark shows up. If you click on the blue tick mark, it magically turns into an orange tick mark for some reason, but it now has a whole slew of choices of what to do with it, including open, share, get public link, get a widget, add to public box, delete, tags, and properties. All kinds of stuff to do with it. Well, the bottom line is that I haven't even come close to exploring everything Box can do for me, but it definitely met my short-term needs, and of course, it's free. For that grand price of zero, you get a gigabyte of storage with a max file size of 10 megabytes apiece. For more storage, you can pay a monthly fee. They have a mobile site for your cell phone at m.box.net, and I'm sure it works on normal cell phones, but for some reason it wouldn't respond to the standard double click of the iPhone to zoom in so that I could read it and see what to do with it. I had to do the inverse pinch, which is much less controlled and less fun, but it does work. Anyway, I think Box.net is a terrific service, works well, uploads very quickly, and does everything I wanted it to for free. I want to do a little bit of clarification on the ads I've been running for Honda Bob. As you recall, Honda Bob is my mechanic, and I just love his service. What I needed to tell you is that he does not provide any warranty service like you would get from a dealer if a part failed that was under warranty. What he does provide is the normal services you have to do if you want to stay within the terms of your warranty. For example, I'm pretty sure if you went 4.5 years without doing an oil change, that 5-year warranty you paid for from Honda would not be any good to you. He put it this way, he provides any of the kinds of services you have to pay for. Well, that's pretty simple. By the way, he does warrant his own work, of course. If something he fixes fails for you, he is definitely there for you to make sure it works. I don't want to give you the impression that happens, but if it ever were to happen, he'd be right there. After all that caveat talk, let's talk a little more about what great service he does provide. Honda Bob actually drives to your house or business to provide service and repair to your Honda or Acura if you live in the Los Angeles area. He's not so keen on driving to New York. You know, he's not going to do that, but LA is pretty big. Imagine sitting back in your Barca lounger, sipping a nice cold drink, watching a ball game while Bob sweats out in the hot sun in your driveway replacing your transmission. Some of that cold drinks taste so much better when you know he's out there slaving away. He says he's happy out there, and that's what makes him so very good at what he does. He simply loves his work. If you're interested in this kind of loving care of your Honda or Acura cars, give him a call at 562-531-2321. Also, check out his website at hdabob.com. HD Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. As you might have noticed, I'm really fond of the tools I've been discovering for checking your disk for big fat files that you forgot about that make you lose all your disk space. We talked about Grand Perspective first for the Macintosh, and then Phil turned us on to Winderstat for Windows. These tools give you a beautiful and useful graphical diagram showing your files. The bigger the box on screen representing your file, the more disk space it's taking up. We all run out of disk no matter how big it is, and it's fun to be able to harvest all that wasted space. Well, Bart sent me in one of these programs for the Mac that I had not seen before. It's called Disk Inventory X from Derlien.com. That's Derlien.com. And of course, the links will be in the show notes. Why do we need another one? Well, maybe because it's cooler. Well, maybe it gives more information about the file. Or maybe it provides easier navigation to that big fat file. Or maybe it rings a bell, plays music. Who cares? Anyway, Disk Inventory X is free and distributed under the GNU public license, so it's gotta be cool. Well, I've struggled with how to describe these kinds of tools, how they draw these little boxes to represent file size according to the Derlian website, these are called tree maps. And get this, Disk Inventory X as a project came to the developer when he was looking at Winderstat. So you see, it all comes together here. Disk Inventory X pops open with a listing of current disk usage and free space. At the bottom, there's a button that says Select Folder. I decided to check my Podfeet folder because big old audio files keep sneaking into that folder somehow. I don't know how. In just a few seconds, I had a two-pane window with a slide-out drawer and an information window. The left pane is a list of folders within the Podfeet folder, and the right pane is the tree map. It has pretty little blue, green, and red rectangles of all different sizes. The pull-out drawer gives you the key to the colors, which is really nice. It shows the largest collection of files at the top down to the smallest with the corresponding colors. For example, most of my rectangles are blue, so it turns out blue means GarageBand projects. That's a pretty specific connection. Not just that it's an audio file, Disk Inventory is smart enough to understand what kind of files you have on the Macintosh. Let's take a quick break to notice that my GarageBand files are taking up 9.2 gigabytes, which is absurd. I only need those files for about a week after the show to make sure no one writes to me to point out that I pronounce Vista backwards or whatever other goofy error I might have done that week. This is good news because it'll let us see how well this tool helps me figure out what files I can delete. I simply hovered over the blue rectangles, and down at the bottom it showed me the file I was viewing. When I clicked on it, the information window came to life, telling me all kinds of information about it. The size, dates created, modified, even the file permissions, and what format the disk was in where it was stored. At the same time, it opened the left pane of folders to reveal the location of the massive file in the directory structure. Remember last April when Paige and I talked to Mark Risen on TalkShoe? Well, it turns out my GarageBand file of that was 645.1 megabytes and still sitting there. Now for the real test. Can I delete it from here, or do I have to navigate to that file to go delete it? Well, it turns out a simple command delete right there, and the sucker is gone. Get this. Unlike all the other applications like this that require you to rescan the folder, Disk Inventory X automatically updates the tree map after you delete. And it makes the cool Apple poof noise and makes a smoke thingy, you know, when you delete the file. That's worth the price of admission right there. Using Disk Inventory X, I deleted all the GarageBand files before July. I started blasting away at the blue rectangles. Boom, 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 just knocking them out of there. I had a ton of them in there. It was so fun. Delete, poof, I went crazy. After a long time, I realized suddenly that the file sizes were getting pretty small, which made me go look at the color map, and the GarageBand files were no longer the biggest group, so it changed what blue meant. No fair. Well, luckily I noticed this in time that I only had one file that I hadn't really wanted to delete, but beware of this, it does change. Blue is always the biggest file, not necessarily the type of file you started with. Now remember that just a few weeks ago I used Grand Perspective to reclaim 25 gigabytes of disk space, so I didn't have high hopes in this endeavor that I would find very much. I had 36.7 gigabytes free to start with, and after my blasting away of every GarageBand file older than July, I found 50 files I didn't need, leaving me with 44.7 gigabytes free, which, if my elementary school arithmetic serves me right, is an additional 8 gigabytes of free space. I really had no expectation that Disk Inventory X would find me more free space, but it did. If you download and like Disk Inventory X from Derlian.com, be sure to give a donation to them. So, Google is taking on Microsoft by creating online versions of a word processor and spreadsheet with their Google Docs and Google Sheet. What if there were a competitor to Google in that arena? Well, enter Zoho from Zoho.com. Zoho has a whole slew of web-based applications, not just a word processor and spreadsheet. They've also got a presentation tool to replace PowerPoint. They've got Wiki software, a notebook application, competing with Google Notebook, a web conferencing application called Zoho Meeting, a web applications creator, an online organizing tool called Zoho Planner, and even a chat client. I don't think I'm going to go through all of them, that's for sure, but I'll highlight the ones that fancy me. Before I get too far into this, I have one thing that always nags me about these online services for software. Let's say I'm working for a startup company, so I don't have any bureaucracy to deal with at all, and I can make my own decisions. My company has the coolest new technology. I'm telling you, we're going to be the next Google. We're sure of it. Would I want my technical documents online at someone else's site? So, if in that example I won't keep those up there, what would I keep up there? All those spreadsheets and presentations I make for fun? And now, take the same question and say you're in a massive corporation like Ford Motor Company. Would you put anything for the company up there? I'm still intrigued by the online model, and maybe the place for this will be a web-based service you can buy for your own internal servers. Anyway, it's cool, so let's play with it. I wasn't thrilled with my initial impression of Zoho. They had a sign-up page, which didn't work on the iPhone for some reason, and then when I tried it on the computer, it had a visual CAPTCHA. No way for the blind to get an account. They should have an audio CAPTCHA, too, so everyone can play. I sent them a letter saying just that. They sent me the confirmation email, and when I clicked the link, it took me to a page where I had to set up which services I wanted to use. Okay, why can't I just click on the one when I want it? No explanation for that, but I had to add each service I wanted to play with. It started with Zoho Creator already in my list, which is the web application's creator tool. But I didn't really want that, so I had to delete it. But whoa, slow down, big girl. Why do you want to delete it? Fill out this form and tell us what's wrong with it. Cripes, I don't want to do that. I clicked remove again without telling them why, and then it came up with a pop-up window asking me to confirm. And then it made me enter my Zoho password after giving me dire warnings about the repercussions of my action, like all of my documents being destroyed. Hey, I didn't even ask for this in the first place. As Bart would say, this made me grumpy. All right, I'm over it now. I'm an Excel fanatic. Remember how I keep promising I'm going to do a tutorial on pivot tables, but I still haven't done it? Someday. So I decided to start with Zoho Sheet. I imported a phone list of my friends, and it pulled in perfectly with my headings and fonts and formatting, just the way it looks in Excel. The menu bar for Zoho Sheet looks fairly familiar. The usual formatting tools, fonts, bold, italic, underline, colors for cells and fonts, border drawing, and ruler justifications. The next icon was something I really wish Excel had. It's a single button click to tell a cell to word wrap. I think they must have really gone to some thought about what we use the most, because I'm always clicking on a cell, going up to format with the mouse, dragging down to cell, then clicking on the alignment tab, and then clicking on the wrap button and saying OK. So tiresome. Well, it turns out they also have buttons to align the content vertically in the cells, which is way too many button clicks in Excel for my taste. And that's when things got seriously hinky. I had a column I wanted to word wrap, so I clicked on column A and I hit the wrap button. Suddenly there's a column B with nothing in it, but the text in column A is crossing over into column B. And then my other stuff is sitting in column C, what used to be in column B. What? I thought maybe I was mistaken and that column B was already there already, so I clicked on the column heading for B and right-clicked and selected Delete the Column. Unfortunately, it nagged me with an Are You Sure dialog box, but then it refreshed the screen and B was still there. I was going to take a screen snapshot to show you, but I didn't want to reveal my friend's phone numbers, so I inserted a row so I could put in fake data. But now when I try to click on row 2, it selects half of row 3 and half of row 4. It's all messed up. This isn't even close to usable if it's this buggy this quick. I mean, it does say beta on top, but jeez. Well, I thought I'd just close this document, start from scratch. So, you know, whatever was in this document, maybe it messed things up. But I couldn't find the close option. I can preview, export, share, publish, or tag it, but close is not an option I can find. There was a pane on the open on the left originally that I collapsed. So it turns out if I open that back up, I now have an option to trash the file. What if I just wanted to close it but not trash it? Thought maybe clicking the trash can would give me an option, but guess what? It didn't even warn me that I was deleting the file. Wait a minute, you're going to sound the alarm if I want to delete a stinking row? But I can delete the entire document, and you don't think I need a warning? Man, that sure is backwards. Luckily, there's a trash can at the bottom that has my file in it, at least. Okay, time for a fresh sheet. Things should behave themselves now, right? I clicked in a cell and I typed dog, D-O-G. It typed O-G-D. Oh, come on. Thought maybe I mistyped it. You know, it's been known to happen. So I clicked on a different cell and I retyped dog. Know what it did this time? It typed dogs in the cell above and kept the O-G-D cell right where the other one was. I tried it in a whole new cell. I typed test and it typed E-S-T-T. Turns out it was taking the first letter, moving it to the end of the word, and then typing the rest of the word in front of it. Just to be sure, I typed Nosilicast, and it typed Osilicast N. I'm sorry, this thing isn't even close to usable. You know what? I'm not even going to test it any further. Maybe that's not fair, but if one app like this is messed up, I think we should wait a bit to see if Zoho gets some more development time under its belt. I love Spotlight searching on Mac OS X, so even though this suggestion came from listener James, I had to give it a try. Inquisitor 3 is supposed to give you Spotlight-like capabilities when searching the web using Safari. According to their site at inquisitorx.com/safari, you should be able to start typing in the search bar, and websites will pop up immediately along with ideas to refine your search. It's supposed to autocomplete your words and let you add more search engines to Safari with customized keyboard shortcuts. Oh, and it's free. Well, I downloaded the installer for Inquisitor 3, and I tried to run it. But it insisted that I had Safari running, even when I completely logged out and back in. Finally, I wrote a snotty letter to the developers, and later on, I launched Safari. I needed to do a search a bit later, and that's when I realized Inquisitor was actually running. I wanted to find advice on what to pack for Italy, so I typed in Italy packing. And before I could finish typing, it had auto-completed it with the word list. So I had Italy packing list now. And it showed three options already searched from the web for me, websites giving advice on packing for Italy. So I didn't have to finish my Google list, then my Google search, and then go look at the list. It was already there. And this is where it gets really cool. I got distracted from doing the review here, and I visited one of those sites. When I went back and looked in the search bar, now it shows the same three sites, but the third one, which I had visited, now moved to the top of the list, and it has a green check mark next to it, and it says I visited it once. I think that's really slick. How many times have you gone back to the same site thinking you were checking a new one? I like what Inquisitor has done to my search bar in Safari, but I can't say I understand it. It's giving me options I didn't have before, but I don't see where these customized keyboard shortcuts are or how to make them do anything. I even went as far as to hunt around on the developer site, but I found no clues. I also don't know exactly where Inquisitor is. Did it modify Safari? If so, and let's say I didn't like it, could I make it go away? It's not in my applications folder, it's not a menu bar app, and it's not listed anywhere in the activity monitor. So I guess I'm going to keep it. Well, luckily I do like it. That's a weird way to end this endorsement, but with any luck, listener James will write in with something akin to, a dork, all you got to do is... dot, dot, dot. Well, stay tuned for that message from James, but in the meantime, check out Inquisitor 3 at inquisitorx.com. Well, I promised you a piece of software that I was really excited about. You know how I love to take screen snapshots and edit them to teach and explain things. I do this all the time for the show notes for Nosilicast, but one thing has been missing for me. An easy way to add text and arrows to the pictures so that I can highlight something in the image. I'm also always on the hunt for an easier way to edit a screen grab. Invariably, I've not cropped it closely enough, and I have some sort of artifact maybe on the side that distracts from the point I'm trying to make. I save these files to disk frequently. I upload them to my website. I embed them in chat sessions, and I email them to people. It would be so cool if I had a tool that could help me do all of that. Well, Leo hooked me up with an invite for the beta program for Sketch from Plask.com. That's plasq.com. You may remember the name because the Plask folks are the makers of the well-known application Comic Life. I think they took some of the tools in Comic Life for editing photos and made them part of a real useful tool. Let's jump in and play with Sketch so you can get a feel for how awesome this tool is. Sketch installs itself as a menu bar application, so it's always ready to go when you need it. Let's say you wanted to take a screenshot of my logo on my website and point out the sarcasm in the phrase, ever so slight Macintosh bias. Click on the Sketch icon in the menu bar, and up comes a window with a whole bunch of tools around the left, right, and bottom. You might be frightened by these, but as soon as you hover over one of them, a peaceful set of hints hovers beside them and tells you what they are. For example, the left side is a bunch of tools like an arrow, a pencil, a line, a circle, and more. Most of them are pretty self-explanatory, but as you hover over them, you find that the really funny-looking one is the fill area icon. You can add text, highlight in yellow, or change the color of highlighting to some other color, and my favorite, add these really snazzy-looking arrows. Arrows are important because they're the easiest way to highlight something for me, and nothing else makes them as easily as Sketch. The best part about Sketch is that you can move things around once you've drawn on the photo. You're not actually changing the bitmap. Highlighting, boxes, arrows, text, all sit on layers above your image so that you can independently move them. Let's say to get that arrow exactly the way you want it. I put a picture in the show notes with a highlighted arrow showing you just how easy it is to crop, too. You don't have to grab the exact framing, you know how annoying that can be. You simply grab the edge and move it in or move it out to add a border. Once you have the image the way you like it, you simply grab the Drag Me tab at the bottom and drag the file anywhere you want it. If you drag it to an email or to a document, for example, it'll simply paste the image into the document. If you drag it to your desktop, it'll make a file there of the image, which you name right in Sketch. You can even take screen grabs directly with Sketch. On the right side, there's a button called Snap. When you hit Snap, Sketch helpfully scoots out of the way and gives you crosshairs to select the part of your screen that you want to grab, and then plops it right into the Sketch window. There's a camera right there, too, so you can take a picture with your eyesight or other connected camera. There's a button at the top that says Photos, and if you click that, you realize it's fully integrated in with your iPhoto library. It's almost like having iPhoto inside Sketch. You can see your folders, and when you click on them, you get thumbnails and a slider to increase the sizes so you can really see them, so you can mess around with your photos. Sketch will integrate into your web post, too, so you can automatically, at the push of a button, upload your images to your website, blog, or to your MySketch account. One thing I found extremely valuable is that Sketch keeps a history of everything you've played with. The screen flips over and you see sections by day going back in time. You can click on an image and bring it back up and edit it just as though you were working on it today. Or you can delete them if you want. You can drag images out of there in a variety of formats, including .sketch, which I think means we can send the layered files with text and graphics that are editable to each other. There are a bunch of modifier key options. Like if you hold down the Option key and use the cursor tool, it'll copy what you're dragging instead of dragging the original. In the wonderful help file, and I'm not being a bit sarcastic there, you'll find a zillion of these modifier keys. Luckily, you don't have to read too much, because if you hold down one of the modifier keys, helpful hints pop up telling you what they do. One thing to keep in mind when you're working with Sketch is to not think too hard. Just like I'm always saying about the Macintosh, if it's hard, you're doing it wrong. For example, I wanted to change the size of one of my images, and I could see the pixel dimensions in the bottom left. I tried right-clicking, looking at tools, hunted all over the place, till I broke down and read the help file. Get this, just drag the corner of your image to make it smaller. That's it. How cool is that? Well, I don't think I've really done justice to Sketch in my description. It's impossible to really give you a feel for how intuitive and enjoyable this program is. Luckily, the brilliant people at Plask have a great video you can watch so you can see it in action. It's also good for training before you get started. I put a link in the show notes so you can pop over there and give it a watch. Now, here's the good part. Skitch is in private beta right now, so you have to be invited. And they gave me 50 invites to give away. Shoot me an email at allison@podfeet.com, and I'll get you hooked up if you're in the first 50. I'm really excited about this software, so go check it out at plask.com. Well, I hope you've enjoyed the show today. I sure had fun. Please keep all this great feedback coming, sending me hot tips on cool software, web-based apps that'll make our lives easier. If you want to send in feedback, email me at allison@podfeet.com. Or if you want to send in audio feedback, send it to nosillacast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.